The Will Cain Show podcast is presented by Eno, the Capital One assistant. What's in your wallet?
Hey, what's up, folks? In this episode of the Will Cain Show interview podcast, I hang out with Kevin Durant's business partner and manager, Rich Kleiman. We talk to Rich about what it means to be a manager, how he got into the business, how he met Kevin, business philosophies, including being an entrepreneur, taking risks, hustling in New York City, and the best players under the age of 25, and whether or not Kevin Durant's the best player in the world. Hope you enjoy. Are you doing okay through all of this?
Yeah, man. I am, you know, taking it one day at a time, as I'm sure you and the rest of the world are. Where are you right now?
I am in Tennessee. I left my home in New York City about 2 weeks ago, and I'm at a home kind of in the Smoky Mountains of Tennessee. It's a nice place to get away to, and I'm grateful for that. And that's where I'm doing my show from right now. What about you?
Well, hold, we're going to get back to that in a second because I assumed you were from Dallas the way you talked about your Cowboys. But I am outside of the city, which is a blessing. But, you know, I live in Manhattan, so it wasn't until a few weeks ago that we got out. And fortunate to be able to do so just because of how scary it is in the city right now.
I live in Manhattan as well, and that's where I left. But make no mistake here now, Rich. I am from a small town outside of Dallas, born and raised.
All right,
This is just a one-day drive I had from the city, the closest place I could get to that I had access to. So that's how I ended
up in
Tennessee.
You drove from Manhattan to Tennessee?
I did, yeah. One day. Yeah.
Wow. All right. Well, then that makes me feel better because if you were this, like, rabid Cowboy fan and you weren't even from outside of Dallas or Dallas, I don't even know where I could start.
Would that bother you? That'd just be like all these, you think they're bandwagon America's team fans? That would really destroy
the vision? It would just give me some more, like, kind of color on what kind of Cowboy fan you are, because I'm all for how much you love them and, like, the goggles that you see them through, because I'm a Giant fan. You know, I get it. And NFC East people, like, as much as I hate each one of the teams individually, I also can, like, still feel some pride in that, like, we're still the best division in football, in my opinion. But knowing that you're a true Cowboy fan now, I feel a little better about it, yes.
I have very, very strong views on this. My belief is this. You don't get to choose your teams. You are born to your teams. You are generally born with geographic assignment to whoever you're a fan of. And that's not just football. That's basketball, because I'm an old school basketball fan, baseball, and every sport. But there is a asterisk. There is a caveat here. If your father or mother brainwashed you because of their affiliation to some other market that you didn't grow up in, then that's okay, because that's what I'm doing with my boys. They're New York boys, born in New York, but believe me, they're Cowboy fans.
Yeah, and I think that's true. I think that's true. You're born into it. I think in New York, though, it also depends on, like, what kind of fan your parents are, because in New York, if you don't have a parent that's just like a diehard Yankee fan, you may lean Met, which I did because I was 10 in 1986 when they won the World Series and everyone loved that team. So, but overall, I agree with you. Here's another caveat, though. If you are in the business I'm in, it's very entertaining to become a fan of, let's say, the Golden State Warriors for the last 3 years, or the Oklahoma City Thunder before that, or the Brooklyn Nets now.
Well, that's convenient for you, right?
Yes, that does become part of the asterisk there.
By the way, Rich, and I have so many questions I want to talk to you about, of course, your career, your relationship with Kevin Durant, but let's follow this line for just a moment. I'm just not one of these new school NBA fans that follows players where they go. I know you have a professional relationship and a personal relationship with Kevin, so I get why you rattled off the Thunder, then the Warriors, then the Nets. But as much as I love Dirk Nowitzki, and I did, I don't know that I would have just become a fan had he moved on to someplace else. I'm a fan of the laundry, the jersey, the franchise that I grew up with. That's just kind of how I view sports. And I probably would have paid a little more attention to wherever Dirk ended up, and I will do the same probably with Luka. But make no mistake, I'm a fan of the franchise.
Yeah, first of all, so you assume Luka will be somewhere else at some point?
No, I didn't assume that, but I'm just saying I already have strong feelings for Luka. Not to the Dirk level, but I have strong feelings for Luka.
I think that's true for sure in football. You know, like, I was devastated the thought of Eli Manning, like, being benched and no longer being the quarterback. And as soon as that next week came around and Daniel Jones played, it was like it never happened. I was completely over it. I'm a Giant fan. And for the same goes for baseball, definitely college sports. Basketball, yes, But if you have like a real affinity for a player, it almost becomes like your fun second team. You know, it's like dessert. You get to root for the team that a Dirk went to or Luka goes to, or on top of the fact that you're a Mavericks fan.
Well, it sounds like you've paid some attention to things I've said in sports media on whatever program it might have been. So I've said a lot of different things about your guy, Kevin Durant, but the truth is he is one of the guys I've followed some level of fandom from one location to another, and that's largely because he's a Texas Longhorn, as I am as well. So it goes back to the same thing, where we affiliated or we have a connection to the same piece of laundry, I guess. And at some point, Kevin and Durant did it, and I did. And there's just a lot more things I like about him as well. So let's get into some different stuff. And we're going to talk about you. We're going to talk about basketball. But let me start with this. Tell me about the first time you met Kevin Durant.
I met him. It was his rookie year. I think he was in town, if I'm not mistaken, to get his rookie of the year trophy. And a friend of mine, mutual friend, an artist when I was in the music business that I was managing at the time, was from the same hometown as Kevin, and told me that Kevin was going to the Jay-Z concert and I should connect with him. And we connected. I met him and his brother that night. And when you, and you know, like, there's a universal language of sport and basketball, I think, more than any other sport. And we just started talking basketball, and that allowed us to kind of get on the level, even though we were 10 years apart in age and grew up in different places and were different places in our life. And we kept in touch just through basketball through the years. And I would see him at different locations, different places. And knowing him now and seeing how much he loves to engage with people that want to speak about sport, it made sense that, like, I met him through a friend and I wanted to talk basketball. And that was like the genesis of our relationship at first.
And at the time, you were working with Roc Nation, but you were in the music side of the business?
Yeah, I was always, my life's goal was to be in sports. I kind of like grew up learning how to read from box scores, and I was fascinated with the business of sport early and the little that was fed to you, like the contracts and the trades. And I loved the energy inside Madison Square Garden and was fascinated with who was sitting courtside. And I always wanted to be around sports, but my journey to really being in the business took like a real strange turn early. I was working on this show, The Life, on ESPN, and they needed somebody to do the music and had really very little money. So I kind of raised my hand to do it and started accumulating all this music from unsigned artists and bands and producers in the city. And that somehow just like catapulted me into the music business. All these artists then started asking me to manage them. And at that age, it was like I figured I'd find my way back to sports. But I stayed close to it. I stayed close to it and knew a bunch of athletes and was still very much like in the arenas and followed it and stayed up to date. But I was in the music business, but I didn't love it. You know, I loved the energy and the speed of the deal making, and I loved the idea of managing these incredible talent that I was exposed to. And then obviously working with Jay-Z was like a lifetime dream, and to see him and watch how he moved and operated, you could learn so much. So I loved that part of it. But, you know, I really wanted to take all that experience ultimately and get back into the sports world, and I was able to do that kind of halfway through my time at Roc Nation.
I didn't know that part of your story. So were you with ESPN, or were you with a production company that was producing content for ESPN? What were you doing when you started trying to accumulate music from unsigned artists?
Well, it was like, this was like, it was in 2000, I think. And no, I was just hustling. I was just like this young kid in New York, had a lot of connectivity. I always kind of prided myself on my network and meeting people and keeping people close to me and being social. And I liked the energy of it all. And I had an idea with a friend of mine had an idea, actually. And he came to me, and I was part of his group, and we pitched this company, Radical Media, which was like the premier agency and production company, and one of them in New York at the time. And they were doing a ton of work with the like classic Nike campaigns. And we told them that we wanted to do this show following athletes behind the scenes, when really that's just life now. But then it didn't exist. So we were part of this group that pitched it to ESPN, and they signed off on 32 episodes, which is crazy, right? And they signed off on it and gave us a shot, and then the production company let my buddy and I and this other group put it together. But I just wanted to be close to the athletes and be, like, around the excitement of it. But they needed someone to do the music, and I just wanted to be close to it. So I started doing the music and then had a budget, and it was kind of like whatever you don't spend, you can keep. So I was like, well, then I'm not spending anything because I want to keep every single dollar. So I tried my best to find all these like unsigned artists, and then those artists ended up being like, this guy's energy and kind of excitement I want around me. So they started asking me to manage them, and then some of those people started turning into successful producers and artists, and And I was starting to get exposed to some of like the coolest things in the music business. And we had incredible Grammy winning artists in and out of our studios. And I was in the business. And I mean, I was featured in 2006 in the New York Times style section as like the manager to the celebrity DJs. And while it was cool in my mind, I was like, this couldn't be farther from where I envisioned myself being. I wanted to be in sports.
But I'm fascinated with that path. I'm fascinated with that journey. So I read, Rich, that you were to high school with Mark Ronson. And is that a big part of this story then, as you're starting to get into DJs and musicians, is having that relationship going back to high school with Mark Ronson a big part of it?
Yeah, we didn't go to high school together. We knew each other from the city. And Mark was like as cool as it got in like 2000, 2001. I mean, earlier than that, starting in like 1993, 94 in the city, this guy would be DJing like the Calvin Klein and Tommy Hilfiger fashion show, and then Biggie Small's birthday party at the biggest hip hop clubs, and then doing like an after hours and every celebrity and hip hop artist in the city was in there, and he's doing Puff Daddy's white parties, and he wanted me to manage him and be a part of what he was starting to do, and that energy and excitement like kept filling that void. Like, that was the stuff I wanted. That was the part of being at the arena and the NBA games that I love. So like, it wasn't the same, but I got some of it, and I was able to keep building my network and keep building my connectivity. And I always knew that, like, one thing I was able to do was I realized that everyone I met, they may not be able to be helpful in the immediate on what I was working on, but I felt like if I continued to build this network, that if I could get to where I wanted to be, that network at some point I could call on and that we could help each other. And there was things that I would always do along the way, and I remember my wife, I got married young, would always say, like, what do these people do for you? Like, you're always going out of your way. And I said, this is how, you know, I believe in this. I believe in myself, and I believe that this is going to come back around, and this is developing relationships. And I got that from the music business. So, like, with Mark, it was like, wait, hold up. So now I'm in the room, and the athletes are in here, the rappers are in here, I'm around everybody, I'm meeting people, I know everybody, and you know, it started to feel like maybe this was a place for me to be, because the one thing I know, if I could call myself one thing, and I've been fortunate to get heavy into the media world and in the VC world, and I really am a manager, like I manage talent. I just, when I met Kevin and was able to build what we have together, I was able to kind of fill all of that. Like, I was managing this like premier talent and incredible individual, and now I could be entrepreneurial and build an enterprise too. But that's like what my skill set was. So with Mark and all the DJs I managed and producers, I knew that at least I was really good at that, and I could help talent get to where they wanted to be.
You said so many things just now that I want to follow up on, so forgive me as I pull on different strings here. But first, will you just explain to me and everyone listening right now the difference between a manager and an agent? I think most of our experience, most of us who are not in the entertainment business, and I am, of course, to some degree, and you clearly are to a deep degree, understand it. But I think my first experience was honestly entourage. Like, you got E and you got Ari, you got an agent and you got a manager. What's the difference, and why are you giving 10% to one guy and 4% to the other? Why do you need them both?
Well, I think it's different in different fields, but in general, what I would say to that is that, like, traditionally the agent is somebody historically an agent has been someone that had like a law degree, that was working on the contract, that was able to kind of finalize whether it was your on-court contract or your production deal with a big studio or your big brand and endorsement deal. And a manager was always kind of seen as somebody that then could manage all those relationships, manage the day-to-day for the talent in terms of all the different demands on their time, the things they had to do to maintain their skill set, whether it was working out or working on their craft, the different people in their family, their foundation, and then also the brands and the deals that the agent may be constructed, being able to activate those and put those in place and be able to communicate to the brand on what it was that the athlete wanted. I think now there is not a big difference. You know, the agencies serve those purposes, and managers, you know, in a lot of ways, I'm not even a certified agent anymore, but managers can act as an agent, especially in sports where there's such a strict salary cap. But I think that, like, a manager is someone that is truly closest to, whether it's the artist or it's the athlete, and has such a kind of, or should have, a true understanding of the vision of what it is that they want from their career and their mission. Whereas a lot of times, like, an agent stereotypically is thought of as, like, somebody that's just trying to get their commission, you know, and a manager is helping build and architect a brand and maintain a brand. But the line is so blurry. I personally, I've always just, like, reacted poorly to the word agent. I also thought it, like, pigeonholed me a bit perception-wise on what it was that I did, and that's important to me, you know. And to some people, they'll tell you, like, don't get caught up in all that. But in the day and age we're in now, like, if you can't be crystal clear about what it is that you do, and for better or worse, let it be known, sometimes it ends up being a detriment. So, you know, for me, I never really felt comfortable with, like, being referred to as his agent.
So you said something about your career path that I think you and I have in common, and then something that are very different. So, first of all, where'd you grow up? Upper East Side, or where were you in the city?
Upper West Side.
Upper West, that's where I live now.
Where do you live?
I live on air. I don't know if I should say. I live on the Upper West Side. More detail, I'll text you. But,
all right,
not everybody likes the things I say now, Rich. So, you know, I have a little distance. growing up a small town in Texas, though, I really have talked to people about this. I believe there's a huge entrepreneurial spirit. And I don't know if it is kind of in the culture in Texas, but a lot of guys that I knew growing up who had no right to believe they were going to start or do things did it because they didn't believe they shouldn't be doing it. And they had big pie in the sky, you know, dreams and big eyes about what deals they were going to do. And I love that about Texas. And I'm not saying everybody in Texas, you know, but I do think there's a general culture. I now live in New York, and listening to you talking about your hustle early on, it just kind of reminds me of something similar. It's just this idea. Look, man, I'll tell you, I think the first time I've ever been a W-2 employee, yep, it was with ESPN. First time I ever got, like, health benefits. It was only before that. It was always businesses I'd started myself, you know?
Yep.
And hearing you, I hear a little bit of the same story. I mean, were you ever thinking I'm going to apply? I didn't have a damn resume forever, Rich. You know what I mean? Like, because I was just going to start or hustle what I was going to do. And that sounds a little bit like your early story.
Yeah, well, I think the thing is I agree with you, and I agree with you about people from Texas, or at least the time I've spent in Austin especially. I think it's, you know, I think if you see somebody that sets out to be a doctor and has the discipline to go through undergrad and then medical school and residency, it's like that's just not for everybody. And it's not just that person wanted to be a doctor. There was something in their skill set and their makeup that allowed them to be able to go through that grind. And I think when people say, like, you know what, oh, I'm going to stop doing that, I'll be an entrepreneur, you can't do that. It's not like something you figure out at a job fair. Being an entrepreneur is definitely a mindset. It's definitely something that you're born with, and not everybody's able to realize that. But for me, I always had that. I had businesses when I was 6, 7, 8 years old. I tried my hand at everything. Every time, if I got a gift, I would think I honestly wanted to sell it. Like, I would want to put it out. I'd stand outside my building. And if it wasn't like a basketball card or a baseball card and someone got me something, I'd be like, all right, I'm going to resell this. Or, you know, I just thought that way. The problem is I think that with a lot of people you meet, both in New York, Texas, anyone, the entrepreneurial spirit like that is, you put your eyes on the finish line and then you just want to do everything you can to get there. But there are certain benchmarks and milestones along the way that you do have to get and have to do. And I think what my biggest problem early on was is I really could talk it, and I knew what I wanted to do, and I think my ideas were there. But there's really no replacing hard work. And I think when an entrepreneur then combines the hard work and the work ethic with it, mm-hmm. then, you know, if it's supposed to be, the sky's the limit. I couldn't connect in school. Like, I just could not connect in school. I couldn't figure out how it was going to help me. And I know it's wrong. I have a 10-year-old and a 6-year-old. It's not the advice I'm going to give them. But it just, for me, I just could not figure out how that was going to help me in what I wanted to do in my life.
Well, tell me if this is something that resonates with you. I've said this. But because I had that entrepreneurial mindset, I always thought of myself as somebody who was built for the home run, meaning if I started a business, and I did several, whatever I did, I had to see the exit. I had to see the outcome. What's the upside, right? And so, therefore, I was always – my mentality was home run, strikeout. I wasn't afraid of strikeouts. I wasn't afraid of failing. That was no problem, right? But the older I get – and I think this is where you're calling it hard work and grind – I've come to value and understand the role of the single. And I talk about this on the Will Cain Show a lot, but, like, I understand that success can be accumulated and probably more often than not is accumulated through a ton of singles. And I think if you can combine the entrepreneurial vision of wanting to see a fence, but realizing sometimes you put more runs on the board with singles, then you have a real combination that can be a success.
Oh, I totally agree. And also, like, to use that same analogy, swinging slower. Or think about in golf. You know, whenever somebody hits as hard as they can, they miss the ball. And whenever somebody hits with all their might, they slice it to the right. If you get the perfect swing and you're efficient and you slow down, usually you hit the right ball. Or like when you hear basketball players, and this was always an analogy that was used when I was younger watching Michael Jordan, was that like he moved in slow motion. And to think about that seemed at that point just like he was a superhero. And he was, but at the same time, when you start seeing things in slow motion, or you start seeing the hole open up at the line, then all of a sudden it starts to make sense. And when you're moving a million miles per hour, which most young entrepreneurs are, you're not going to see that hole. It's like when you see a running back who's quick as could be going back and forth and darting back and forth, but they just missed the hole. It didn't matter how quick and fast they were. They missed the hole. So I kind of tried to implement a bit of that in my life as I got older and start to be a bit more patient. But I never lose that same, like, dreamer mentality. I mean, I think even for me during this time period we're in now, you know, I'm thrusting myself into work, but I'm not doing it gratuitously. Like, I know that, you know, the work that I'm doing philanthropically is what we can do to help what's happening in the world now. But I also know that, like, I have to stay in that energy. I have to stay in that energy to be productive in anything I do in life, whether that's just, like, taking care of my family. And that's not for everybody. But that kind of speed that our minds work at, you, me, and you do have it. You are an entertainer. And I see it when I see you on your show, is that, like, there's so much you want to say. That sometimes I used to watch you early on with Stephen A. and Max, and, like, you'd be smiling like before you were going to say something because you knew you had it. You knew you had a gem you were about to come with, or you knew you had something you wanted to kind of debate quick right off the bat, whether it was right or wrong. And that's that same energy that I just try not to ever lose. But slowing it down has been crucial for me.
Well, you know what that is, to be honest? Whenever you saw me smiling or something at Stephen A. or Max, it's actually exactly what you're talking about, of it slowing down. When I'm in those conversations, I'm in those debates, I feel – there's a thing that happens sometimes where it's just like everything starts going slow and I know what Stephen A is about to say. I can see the argument unfolding. I'm not trying to sound like I'm, oh, you know, but that's what I feel. Like I can see, I know what he's going to say. I already know what I'm going to say in response. I know how this conversation is going to unfold. And it's not because I'm not listening. It's because I am listening. You know what I mean? And it's all slowed down and I'm smiling because it's fun. It's fun. Here we go. I know where this is going. That's what that is, to be honest.
Yeah. No, I understand. I get that. And probably early on you missed sometimes what was being said because you were waiting and a bit anxious about having to come in on your response. But when you started to feel like you were in your zone, it's like you could hear every word that was being said. You know your time's coming and you know you're in your pocket and you could see it.
What I wanted to ask you, you said about – so you and Kevin have now not just your management of his basketball career and everything else that's going on and the philanthropy, as you mentioned, but you have a venture fund and you guys are investing in a ton of businesses. I've read about how you're handling this current environment and talking to your CEOs. And I don't think this is being vulturistic to ask this question or too gratuitously opportunistic, but the world is recentering itself, you know, and there's going to be something new that comes out of this, something new of value, and that maybe it's media, maybe it's the way we do things. Have you already started to see that, like not just how we can help, but where the opportunities are as well?
Well, I think I can speak for myself in terms of, like, there's a different facet to our business. The management of Kevin and his business has kind of like a mesh now into 35 Ventures in general, and we do invest in early stage technology and different early stage private equity deals, but we've really now transitioned more into like a media and brand company. And we have a slew of shows and series that are launching, one on Apple. We have the Marbury documentary. We had Cue Ball that was just nominated for a Sports Emmy. I'm definitely plugging right now. But the main thing is the boardroom. And the boardroom is something that we're so passionate about because the platform is very much to represent the conversation we just had. Like, my entry point into the world of sports was so unorthodox and unconventional. The dealings that go on behind the scenes now don't look anything like what people always believed them to be. And the way we reported on sports or read about it to this point had always been from a business standpoint was like Sports Business Journal, and I like it, but that's for all of us. That's for the industry. What fans and young kids aspiring to be in this world that I always wanted to be in but weren't going to play sports didn't always entail having to go the traditional route. And the business of sport and the culture around sport now is what the boardroom is fully trying to bring to its consumer. And I think during these last few weeks, what I've realized is that while we started in the business of sport, it's really just the conversation around it. And we've been having so much content and so many opportunities to have conversations with people that are taking all different like direction. Even in our convo with Chris Godwin the other day, which started as like, what are you doing during your free time, talking to him right now about being in quarantine, about his love for photography, and then just kind of seeing how his mind works, and then talking to him about Tom Brady coming in. And the whole thing is like, was there a direct business angle there? No, but what it does is it gives you like a real insight into how athletes are thinking, executives are thinking, and the conversations and the deals that come out of it and the business that comes out of it. And now I feel really passionate about this platform that we built. And I think during this time frame, what you're seeing is that, like, no matter what changes come in the world, people need to be informed. They need to be informed accurately. And I think we're seeing that as an entire society now, how scary it is to not know what you're hearing and not hear what you know to be the truth or not. And for me, I think that, like, we just want to have a point of view and a conversation on sports. And sports is a common language, a universal language for all of us. And it's why when sports were canceled, this, like, really just hit us all as so real. So I think, like, for us, this seems to be a time where, like, we can kind of throw that energy into having conversations and giving people an outlet to talk and communicate about what their emotions are during this time and what they're doing. And listen, the world is stopped, but we aren't stopping, you know? So all of us, like you having this show, it's like we're all scared. We're all at home, but we are continuing on with our business because when you look at them each individually, like, no, we're not changing the world here. And we realize that we're powerless in the bigger issues now, but we're all a part of it. So it's like I'm seeing that this platform that we built has a real future, and it's been exciting to see that even in this kind of really awful time.
Yeah, and that's exactly what I mean. I think this time has shown me that I am going to reprioritize things that matter and things that have meaning. It doesn't by any means exclude sports, because sports has meaning. And honestly, that's what I love about sports. There's so much life baked into it. Resilience, win-loss, competitiveness. Will you quit? Will you play by the rules? What do you do when nobody's looking? These are all the things beyond the laundry we joked about at the beginning that I love about sports. And for me, meaning has an opportunity here. I guess that's what I'm getting at. And you're an entrepreneur. You guys have not just an entrepreneurial mindset. You have a venture fund, as you mentioned, 35 ventures. And I think for people out there, it's not just about meaning for anyone. I think there's hope. Like, you know, anytime things are shaken up, there's opportunity for not just guys like you, you know, or me. It's for anyone. There's hope on the outside of this of how we can reshuffle and reprioritize things that are better. That's what I seem to, that's what I, maybe that's what I'm just telling myself.
No. I agree with you. Well, by the way, everyone may not kind of fulfill what you just said, but you will, and I will. I feel the same way. Like, I think there's certain things that just seem so trivial. And if there are some societal changes that come of this, that'll be good. You know, that'll be for the good. And I think the same thing, like when we're having some of these interviews, like I can't even imagine asking certain questions or even answering certain questions that I would have 4 or 5 weeks ago. You know, and maybe things will go back and I don't know if they will, but, you know, at least for me, I don't think I want to go back to kind of having the same mindset either.
Right. Let me ask you some of those questions you probably got asked 3 or 4 weeks ago. Well, first of all, you know, you guys, is Kevin was diagnosed with coronavirus. How's he doing?
He's good. He's completely cleared, and he's on the other side of it and never had symptoms, and again has like been cleared by the doc. And
never had symptoms. One of those cases we hear about. Never really felt sick or anything like that.
No, not at all.
Wow. Wow.
Was able to kind of, you know, get through his 14 days and be cleared by the doctor. And, you know, but still, it's like you get through it, and there's obviously, personally, there's some feeling of like, okay, well, you're reading that you're now immune to it, and that's something that can make you feel good yourself. But for him, I think the same fear for, like, the whole world is with all of us in confusion. So, you know, he's still isolated because, like, that's what we're all supposed to do. But him himself, you know, he feels good, and fortunately he's gotten through it. So thanks for asking.
Sure. What about the idea of him coming back if the season's delayed, gives him extra time to heal? Is that realistic?
Well, I'll answer it this way. I don't personally even think it's realistic that the NBA come back. So
really?
Yeah. Yeah.
So canceled?
I mean, listen, this is my feeling on it. And I will put to the side for a second the economic ramifications, which I know are real. And I know that there's an economy to stimulate and there's people that work and there's big media dollars. And I'm not taking away from that. And I do believe that Adam is the right leader, as always, to figure that out. I mean, I think in a lot of ways, if Adam was the president, I feel like we would all have been in better position through all of this. But I'll tell you that it's hard for me to imagine that an NBA season could return when you hear the numbers of casualties predicted, when you hear the numbers of people that will be inflicted by this, and to think that these guys can just go. You know, and I do understand that all of us are working within these conditions, for sure, but we're not working within these conditions by saying we have to quarantine before, get isolated into a certain place, perform in front of no fans, maybe leave our families to do so, work in a condensed season after taking potentially a month or 2 months off. And then if you restart the season in December or November after that, if that ends up being the case, God forbid someone in this condensed season comes back and gets hurt. And listen, this may be totally met with, like, disagreement because is a lot of like, well, woe is me to these guys. They're getting paid, and Kevin got 90% of his money. Putting all that aside, and I know that is stuff that's real to people, right? But what I'm saying is, how does that happen? Maybe some things are just not salvageable. You know, in these lockout seasons, when the lockout ends, they don't go, okay, well, let's add another 32 games on the other end of it. The reality is like the NBA and the NHL happen to have the end of their seasons occur in the middle of this. And the NFL and baseball can probably start later and push back training camps and OTAs. But for the NBA, it's like, I don't know. Like, maybe it's just unsalvageable. And I get it. There'll have to be something to be figured out from the financial standpoint. And I'd love to be able to have a voice in that because I understand it's real. But what I do know is that maybe this just can't be fixed. And maybe in June, we should be thinking about how we get a draft up so these kids that are coming out of college that lost eligibility and all those different instances can have some bit of a normal draft. And maybe we just have to figure out how to make sure that we have the new protocol to start training camp in October. I don't, maybe that's it. I just find it hard to believe that an NBA season is like what the world is really going to need. And I'm as big a sports fan as anyone, you know. But I hear, like, I heard Mark Cuban on the radio saying that this would be really important for America to have this distraction. And, like, I got it after 9/11. I did. You know, I lived in New York City. When Mike Piazza hit that home run, like, yeah, we all needed that. Like, seeing Derek Jeter on the field, we all needed that for sure. But I don't know if this is the same. I don't know. You know, I don't know because we all still don't understand. We don't understand what the society will be like when we get back. We don't know what the new norm is going to be. So, like, how do we thrust the players and the coaches and the league into that? I don't know. I don't have the kind of X's and O's to answer it, except I don't see it personally.
It is a hard logistical thing to square. It's hard to figure out the bubble city idea. It's hard to figure out a truncated season. It's hard to figure it all out. I understand. On that note, if we did have a canceled NBA season, if we did hit a sort of hard restart button here, I'm curious if you could change the NBA for the better in one way, maybe logistics, maybe whatever, playoffs, however you want to do it, how would you do it?
Ooh. Well, I love the NBA. When we're all missing it the way we're missing it now, like, my quick answer is, like, I love the NBA. Nothing. I mean,
I got a ton of ideas. I can give you a lot of ideas how to make it better. I love it, too.
Well, I know, but so let me think about it. Now, when you ask that question, do you mean in terms of, like, structure of, like, the way the playoffs are set up or the seeding? Are you looking at things like that?
Yeah, like, I'll tell you my favorite one. I want that. And Adam Silver is talking about it. That mid-season tournament, I love it, man. I'm a soccer fan, so I'm used to multiple trophies. A one-and-done March Madness-style middle-of-the-season tournament where anybody can win a basket. No seven-game series, right? This has got more unpredictability baked into it. I would be all in on that kind of tournament mid-season.
So So what, it would be all 30 teams playing in a one-and-done, or they'd be like...
Yep.
And then you'd have your mid-season champ, and then...
And it would be less meaningful. It'd be less meaningful than the NBA championship, obviously. But to give, I mean, you know, if we have a problem with teams starting to tank, what, halfway into the season or whatever it may be, all of a sudden there's something more to play for, something more for those fan bases to be involved in. I love it. I really do, Rich.
I mean, I don't know if I love that. I always thought maybe, what if you reverse the lottery? So, like, the best team that didn't make the playoffs got the first pick. I wouldn't do much for, like, the development of some of these younger and teams not doing as well. But I always thought
that solves tanking, right? That's what that does.
Really get rid of tanking. It would almost be like, you know, in fantasy football when the you don't make the playoffs and all the other teams start going at it again. It's, you know, that way at least they don't check out. But I haven't really thought that one through logistically. I mean, I don't like the idea of a shortened season. I mean, I'm kind of like, I love the history and the legacy. Like, when you grow up studying it since you're a kid, and I'm sure you did too, like, I don't want that taken away. I don't want to make some of those old records irrelevant. Like, we love when people break records. So now we're just going to have to cut so many of these records off and asterisks off. Like, they won't mean as much. And that is part of how we entertain ourselves, and you guys cover it all the time. I think the reseeding in the playoffs could be really cool. Like, you know, for me, it's like when intra-league baseball happened at first. Like, it was kind of like, why? But then when it happened, you were like, well, this is cool. This makes sense. And then... if you did that with the playoffs where, like, the Eastern and Western Conference meant less and you reshuffle teams, that could be cool.
Well, let me fix your lotto idea. I'm going to make it a little better. I don't mean to fix so presumptuously. But I agree. Tanking is the thing to solve. That's a problem. So what about this? All the teams that don't make the playoffs, you're now in a one-and-done tournament. And obviously the better teams will have a better chance. You win that tournament, you get top pick. So you got to play for the higher seed. You got to play to win. No more tanking, and we get an entertaining tournament to establish the draft order instead of a lottery.
That could be cool. That could be cool, too, and you could do it for, like, 2 weeks and then give, like, all the playoff teams, like, a two-week training camp prep, almost like Super Bowl weeks, and then maybe you go farther into the summer. That could be cool.
Yeah, so maybe we hit the hard reset here. You know what the funny thing about the NBA is? This is the one thing I like about Adam Silver and the NBA. You don't have to hit a reset to be innovative. Silver's thinking about a lot of these kind of ideas anyway, and that's great.
Yeah, that's what I meant by, like, you know, in this case, I think that Adam will do the right thing. So it's like I kind of give my opinion based on emotion, but I understand that, like, the heavy lifting on this decision-making, which – fortunately and unfortunately, doesn't really pertain to, like, me in this case, or Kevin. But I think he'll do the right thing because he's got such a gauge on, like, the pulse of society. Like, you just see it with how he deals with thing after, you know, China, and then when his friend and the ex-commissioner David Stern passed, and then obviously Kobe's passing, all of these things that, like, you know, are such hard things for all of us to wrap our heads around and as a society, and then he's asked to speak on the front lines after these things happen, and he always does it pretty flawlessly. So I do think, however the NBA handles this, he'll do it the right way. It's just like, I'm sure you feel the same way. Like, could you imagine right now on April 2nd with what you're seeing on the news that in 2 months it's just like, all right, let's get, you know, the NBA guys back together. We're going to isolate them, and they're going to play. And then, like, yo, I'm sure the nation's going to feel better because the Bucks and Pacers are playing this Friday. Like, that's just, I don't see it.
Right. I told you earlier that I shared something with you in our background. I thought that was the entrepreneurial approach to our careers. I also said there was one thing that we were different on, and that's your value and ability to network. I never could master that, man. I did not like it. I don't like going to networking events or cocktail parties. I don't remember I don't know, man. I don't know if it feels transactional to me in terms of the relationships. I don't know if it's always like there's an angle or it, you know, so I will say this, Rich. I can tell you the biggest values in my life, and it has guided me through what I've done on television, but also behind the scenes as well. Like, I truly, truly have an aversion to anything I do not feel is authentic, right? Like, I make my show, we joke about the truth, you know, I have a monopoly on the truth. It's just like, I may end up wrong, but I'm going to get there honestly. I promise you that. Like, I believe what I believe, and I'm authentic about it. And I guess sometimes that networking process to me lost, and I'm not saying it is that way, and I'm not saying you're that way. I'm saying for me, it felt at times inauthentic. So I was always bad at the networking part of it.
Yeah. Well, it can be, and some people are, but if you're not, I always found it to be informative. Like, for me, it was like, I always think about this. I take for granted the fact at times that I can talk, and you can talk as well, too. That's what you do for a living. And a lot of people, that's their biggest kryptonite. They just can't speak. They can't speak in public. They can't speak in rooms. They don't know how to advocate for themselves. I've never had a problem with that. So I think sometimes that people are reluctant to, like, network because of fear. For you, it sounds like you always found it to be a bit inauthentic, but, you know, you can see those people. I don't want to network with people that I think are full of either. And if people right. that I think are, you know, are talking to me for the wrong reasons, or when I was younger and that I felt like weren't really giving me any time of day, I didn't stick around for that. But I've been able to meet some of my closest friends from networking at first and through business. And, you know, especially if you're so passionate about your business and your craft the way we both are, and fortunate enough that they're rooted in sports. So it's like we don't have to, like, check out from speaking about, like, oh, God, man, I don't want to talk about the market all weekend. Like, that's not our world. We want to talk about sports. So I always found it to be, like, very informative, and I could meet people that gave me different perspectives on life. And but mm-hmm. it comes with the slowing down. You should network more now because people know you, and people probably don't know certain sides of you. Like, I didn't even know this side of you to have a conversation like this at all. I never imagined.
What do you think I'd ask you on these kind of things? Like, you that I'd want to debate China with you, maybe? Adam Silver?
So you, like, the level like this, to this degree, and I love that because I also think that if athletes were able to see this side of reporters more and journalists more, they would be more inclined to speak. Because yeah. I know for me, like, Kevin chooses to speak to who he thinks he's going to have a great conversation with. So some people will be like, I don't understand. He passed up Wolf Blitzer, but I saw him talking to so-and-so on this podcast. I'm like, yeah, because that's his friend. Like, what do you mean? Like, and I think from the standpoint of, like, Will Cain, if you were able to show, and I guess you do with your podcast, but, like, the fact that you speak this way, I can imagine there's so many other entrepreneurial athletes and executives in sports that would love to come on and have this kind of conversation.
I think it's
cool to see this because I think when you go up to people and you network, you're going to realize that so many of those people are like this as well. And I've just been able to meet some, like, fascinating people that have helped me change how I look at business, have given me, like, the courage to take certain steps in my career that I may not have. And again, I don't have that fear, but I also use the logic that if most people are uncomfortable speaking, then the people they're going to speak to are probably uncomfortable as well. So you're both better off just getting it over with. And I just don't have that kind of fear. And I bet part of it for you, I'm not projecting, or I can't accuse you of this, but I would assume that part of the networking you don't like is just that it's uncomfortable, right?
Probably. Yeah, that's probably fair. Yeah. It's just, I hate the chit chat. I hate the all of it. Yeah,
well,
but
small talk the worst.
Yeah, it's the worst.
I hate small talk, though. But that's the other thing. I drive people away sometimes because some people will come up to me and they'll be like, hey, man, what's up? Yeah, how's Kevin? Yeah, you know, I saw the Marbury doc. And I'll be like, man, let me tell you something. And I'll just, like, get deep on, like,
I do the same thing. I will make them uncomfortable because I'm like, let's just get to something real as quickly as possible. Something
exactly.
real. What did you do?
I've been talking about this virus for a long time. And I'm not, like, saying I'm a prognosticator. But I do know that, like, I would go 4, 5, 6 weeks ago, and I, like, this is something that was real in our world, and people don't want to get deep. People don't want to really get serious. And Kevin's that way, too. So it's like sometimes, like, I think when people give him a hard time for communicating back and forth on social media, what always makes me, like, confused a bit, well, not confused, but what I know, because I know him, is that, like, those conversations are actually quite challenging. You know, like, you know, some of it is entertaining and fun, and it's a sign of the times, and these are the platforms that generations now speak on. But also part of it is, like, he's met some really fascinating people. Like, we're about to announce a deal in the next few months, or I may wait on it now, with somebody that's going to join our network to talk, like, straight hoop, like, high IQ, sophisticated basketball conversation. Not for everybody. And he met him that way. He met him
on social media
that this guy didn't agree with him about. And they went at it, and they talked, like, high-level basketball. And I think that, like, that's missing at times in media
today.
And
this guy earned Kevin's respect through social media and going back and forth?
Yeah, and think about it. That's the same thing that people say he's ridiculous for, but this guy's going to end up joining our company shortly. You know what I mean? And we're creating a platform and are a part of the boardroom that's going to be a bit more about sophisticated basketball talk from a conversation they had. So it's like, you know, I think that, like, it's interesting because I hope that there's – and I maybe that's what this is. Maybe that's what you just said and we don't even realize it. You said that what you put meaning into will be different after this time. Maybe journalism will be a bit different after. Like, do you really want to have a conversation in October now about, like, is there an asterisk next to Kevin's two championships? Like, I don't – I mean, come on, man. There's way more – like, I don't know.
Well, there's always room for dessert too, though. So,
sure. Yes, for sure.
Like, who's the top – like, who's the best basketball player under the age of 25?
Who do I think it is?
Yeah, there's always room for that. Yeah, who is
it? Yeah, let's talk about it. Well, you think it's Luka.
you could – but I'm not biased. It's true. Who else would it be?
Who else is in there? Trey Young, Carl Zion. Towns, Ben Simmons, Joel Embiid. How old is the Greek Freak?
I think Giannis the list that everybody does is under 25. So I think Giannis is 25, isn't he not? And – or maybe I've aged it up too much. And Embiid is as well.
Yeah.
Zion.
Zion, yeah. How old's Jokic?
Oh, that's good. He's right about that here. I don't know.
He's so – he's an odd anomaly, right? Like, just like – he'll end up playing like 20 years, having stats in the top 10 in like two or three categories and just never be in a conversation.
Never. Because never. He looks like he's 40 the whole time. He's
20. There's players that just never get in the conversation, no matter how good their stats are. I don't know. I think Luka. Yeah, I mean, I'm trying to think because it's like I love. It's interesting because I really love Ben Simmons' game, but I know at least now where the liability is. But I mean, I watched him play his MLK Day game versus the Nets was one of like the best I've ever seen him play, both sides of the floor. So I mean, Luka's special, man. He really is.
It's probably
I didn't
Luka.
Love how him and Porzingis were playing together earlier in the season, though.
It was starting to come together there at the end.
It was, finally, because Porzingis is good, man. He's really good. And there were some games he was going off when Luka was hurt, and there were some games that I didn't like the way he looked in the offense. But then, you're right, the last like 10-15, they looked really good together.
The name we didn't mention we probably should have is Jason Tatum. He's also been playing awesome.
Oh, my God. He might be my favorite. Of all
yeah.
of them, actually.
Yeah, number one.
Yeah, I think Tatum, Luka. I mean, Joel is different. He's so special, but, like, you know, it's just.
He's too old, too. He's 25 or older now. So.
Oh, is he? I think Tatum and Doncic. I think Trae Young gets a bad rap, though. Like, I think, you know, Trae's one of those people that people want to focus on what he can't do, and, like, what he is doing is just incredible as well. But I think, you know, Luka and Carl Towns doesn't get enough credit either. But, you know, the problem is that when you're not winning, it's tough. It's tough. So, you know, for Luka, who's got a team that's winning now, and Tatum, whose teams are winning, it's tough not to give that an edge.
Well, before he got hurt, I don't even know why I would tell you this, but I definitely was on the Kevin Durant's the best player in the world wagon. Of course, I'm not totally objective. I am a fan. I am a Longhorn fan. I've liked Kevin. We'll arrive at the end of this thing here, but I mean, I will tell you on the social media thing, I love that you tell me there was an upside. I do worry because listen, I feel the negativity. We all do. You open that thing up and it poisons your brain. And sometimes when I see Kevin going back, you know, I don't think I'm being patronizing to say it just, you worry about somebody who's sensitive and who sees that stuff and responds to it, and you just think that's not healthy. I'm glad there's upsides, too, which you just described to me.
Yeah, but I do. I also think that, like, it may not be healthy for everybody. But, you know, I think that it's like while he's been doing all this, let's just say since the last 4 years, if you want to use the word healthy, right? And if it's the only way to judge it from the outside because – it's like, who are you guys, not you, but anybody, to decide
that's
what's
okay.
like help him mentally, right? So
yeah.
I can tell you he's as happy and sound mentally as anyone I've ever met. He's been, when he's healthy, the most as successful at any sport at any level that we've seen, dominating. His business, his charity, his foundation, his family, everybody flourishing. So it's like, I mean, maybe he enjoys it, man, and maybe it's just like, more common than you think, because in other like in music, people do that all the time, and someone wouldn't be like, damn, like Travis Scott, what's up with him? Like, people do it. It's just actually part of like the culture now. It's part of this generation. And Kevin's just such a big star, such a big level, and we report on it so much. Like, if there was a music channel that was like, last night Drake responded to someone on Instagram, people would be like, what's wrong with Drake? People don't do that. They don't report on it. But it does happen. And the truth is that, like, Kevin really just goes back and forth with these guys. And honestly, I've never once said maybe you should chill, because I know that it doesn't affect him in any negative way. So, you know, I'm a pretty honest guy, and I would tell him if I thought, like, man, this seems to be really messing you up. It never has. Even never has. Like,
well, I'm happy to hear that. I really, really am for him. That's great.
It's true.
So the networking has worked. The entrepreneurial mindset has worked from hustling on the New York City streets to the music business to Roc Nation to Roc Nation Sports to now out with Kevin and managing him and your venture capital businesses. Man, it's working for you, bud.
Thank you.
I really enjoyed this. I don't know if this is what you thought it was going to be, but I just wanted to get to know you and hear your story. And I appreciate all the time you gave me.
I loved it, and I'd happy to come and talk whenever you'd have me. So stay safe and healthy. Let's not talk Cowboys, but next time we talk, we'll talk deep Cowboys.
Okay, we can text each other about the Upper West Side, by the way. Figure out where you grew up. Okay.
Yeah, perfect. I'd love that. We'll have a talk on the Upper West when the world opens up again.
All right. Good to meet you, Rich. I appreciate it.
Too, man. Take care.